So it's our last lesson in Genesis, and we'll move on into Exodus and Job in March. It's hard to believe we're already at the end of February. So Genesis chapters 46 through 50. So we last left Israel with him learning that his long-lost son, Joseph, is alive. And not only alive, but that he had actually prospered in the land of Egypt. And so chapter 45 that we studied through Wednesday night concludes with Israel saying he's going to go to Egypt and he's going to see Joseph before Israel himself dies, which of course doesn't happen for his death doesn't occur for many years later. So chapter 46 then opens with Israel and all of his household traveling on their way to Egypt, and they travel to Beersheba and they offer sacrifices to God there. And, you know, Beersheba should sound familiar to us because we've been reading, Isaac in particular traveled through Beersheba, actually settled in Beersheba. Seems like he spent most of his life, there in Beersheba. So Jacob's father, lived in and had settled there, had dug a well there, and really had found a place for him and his household there. And so in Beersheba, it's here that God once again speaks to Israel, speaks to him, it says, in visions in the night. So similar to really the first time that God spoke to Jacob at Bethel on Jacob's way on his journey north to Paddan Aram, away from the wrath of his brother Esau. So when God speaks to Israel, first of all, how did God identify himself to Israel? It's right there in the first couple of verses. Right. He starts off with, I am God. And he says, I am the God of your father. And It's interesting in verse one of this chapter, when Jacob offers sacrifices, he says, or it's the record says that he offered sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac. And so now God identifies himself to Jacob as, I am God. I am the God of your father. So if we look back to all the times that God has spoken to Jacob, I think there were six times. And the first of those is in chapter 28. And this is the first time that we read about God speaking to Jacob. He's at Bethel. Actually, it was Luz at that time. He renames it Bethel. And there God identifies himself there in a slightly different way. He says, I am Yahweh. He uses that term. So what we know to be the proper name the proper name for God. He says, I am Yahweh, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. And so he uses, God, he identifies himself as Yahweh, and he uses the terms Elohim, which we've talked about before and read in Hebrew. That's a term for God. It's more of a generic term for God, carries with it the idea of deity or power and might. It's a word that in and of itself is plural in its form. So God uses those two different terms there when he speaks to Jacob. And then if we flip forward a little bit in chapter 31, God speaks again to Jacob, and there he uses the term El. He says, I am God of Bethel, or I am El of Bethel. So it's like he's saying, I am the El of Bethel. And again, a generic term for God, carries with it the idea of being, in front of, again, the idea of power. And that's how God identifies himself. Then in chapter 32 is that incident where Jacob wrestles with a man who Jacob later understood and understood to be God, but God doesn't really identify himself to Jacob in that way, in that in that instance. And then chapter 35, God tells Jacob this time, get up and go to Bethel. And there he identifies himself again as El. So there he's going to Bethel and he uses the term El. And that term El, it's often associated with something else, like the God of Bethel, the El of Bethel. Or later on, it's identified with an altar that God tells Jacob to build. So in this chapter 35, verse 1, he says, go to Bethel and make an altar to God, uses that term El there. Then in chapter 35, a few verses later down in verses 9 through 13, God speaks again to Jacob, and he uses the term El Shaddai there in reference to himself. The, you know, God Almighty is the way it's rendered in our English translations. And then again, this last time that we're reading about here in chapter 46 is the last time we read about God speaking to Jacob, and he uses the term Elohim, actually both El and Elohim. He is God El and the Elohim of your father. And this is, as I said, this is the last time that God speaks to Jacob. So God identifies himself in a few different ways, but makes it clear to Jacob who he is and his relationship, not only with Jacob, but with his ancestors, with his fathers as well, Abraham and Isaac, sometimes by name. So then, so an interesting point, how does God identify Jacob? What does he call Jacob or Israel? One of those two, right? Yeah, right. He calls him Jacob, actually, in this verse. And that's interesting because back in chapter 32, when Jacob wrestles with God, God changes his name, says, you will no longer be known by Jacob. But here, this last time now that God speaks with Israel, he calls him Jacob, perhaps reminding Jacob of his, you know, kind of his low estate, really, the first time that God really appeared to him and spoke to him. So Jacob's about to leave the land that God had promised him all along and promised to his fathers. He's about to leave that land now and go down into a foreign country. And in fact, a foreign country that God had told his father Isaac not to go down to. So, you know, Jacob probably needs some level of reassurance at this point in time. And, you know, one of the first things that God tells Jacob is don't be afraid. And we see that, you know, we see that in other places too. And so God reassures Jacob, gives him this reassurance that, you know, that he's still going to be with Jacob even as he proceeds and travels down to Egypt. So we read, you know, God speaking to Abraham weeks ago, and there's about seven different exchanges that go on between Abraham and God. And some of them are pretty long. You know, we read about these times when God speaks to Jacob, and there may be just a couple of verses. We read about Abraham, and sometimes there's these conversations and these dialogues, really, that go on between God and Abraham. And then, interestingly, we only read about two times that God spoke to Isaac. One, you know, both times conveying promises, but one of those two times also instructing Isaac, don't go down to Egypt. And then we read about these six times when God speaks to Jacob. So it's just interesting, kind of the different levels of, I guess, interaction that we read about between some of these patriarchs and God. So what are the promises that God made to Jacob in this exchange? First of all, you know, don't be afraid. Right? Don't be afraid to go to Egypt. And you probably needed to be told that. There's a famine in the land. He's going to a land his father had been told not to go to. It's a foreign country. It's not the land that God had promised to him. But then there's some other promises that God makes.
Make you into a great nation. Joseph's hand will close your eyes. I'll
right.
Wake up again.
Good. Thank you, Larry. Yeah. So God continues to promise, I'm going to make you a great nation down there. God says that he would go with Jacob down to Egypt and bring him back up again, and that Joseph would close his eyes. So yes, he'll see Joseph again, and he'll be with Joseph until he dies. Then in verses 8 through 27, there's this enumeration of the children of Israel, or the sons of Israel, at least. Why do you think that's included here in the text? Read through it. It's a bunch of names, a lot of them we don't read about other places very much. Why might that be, or might have been significant? Any thoughts on that?
Most of the tribal divisions of the name come down east.
Right. Yeah, Bill makes a point that these really are the tribes now coming out of Egypt. So if we think about the initial readers of this book that Moses is writing, they're coming up out of the land of Egypt several hundred years after the events that we're reading about here. And so it really helps them to learn their history and how it was that as a people they ended up down in Egypt in the first place, and about God's promise that he would bring Jacob back up out of Egypt. And I think that use of Jacob there isn't necessarily Jacob's person himself, but maybe all those that descended from Jacob who were with Jacob at that time when God spoke to him, who were going to go down into Egypt, who were going to become a great nation. And of course, God would bring them as a people back up out of Egypt. Right. So Jacob gets down into Egypt and Joseph meets him, and Jacob Joseph brings Jacob and presents him to Pharaoh. So Jacob gets an opportunity to be in front of Pharaoh. And what does Jacob do? It's interesting.
He blesses Pharaoh.
Yeah, thanks, Clevin. Right. Jacob blesses Pharaoh. And then one of the questions that I asked was, why this might be interesting in comparison to what we read earlier about Melchizedek and Abraham, because there's some blessing that goes on there back in Genesis chapter 14. Anybody give or have any thoughts on that?
Well, at least you use the overlay in Hebrews, the greater blessing.
Right. Yeah. So over in Hebrews, Bill makes the point that in chapter 7 and verse 7, where the writer of Hebrews is recounting this incident back in Genesis chapter 14 between Abraham and Melchizedek, that Melchizedek blessed Abraham. And the point the Hebrew writer is making is that Melchizedek was greater than Abraham, because Melchizedek was the one blessing Abraham. We talked about that. So then we see this incident where Jacob is in front of Pharaoh and Jacob blesses Pharaoh. So, as I was reading that, I was just thinking that would have probably struck the Israelites reading this, because the way the Hebrew writer refers to that, it's like it's common knowledge. The Hebrew writer says, there's no dispute. The greater blesses the less. So that's like I was saying, well, that's common knowledge. Everybody knows that. And so then with that frame of mind or that understanding, then, these readers, we read, well, Jacob blessed Pharaoh. So Pharaoh, one of, if not the most powerful, leaders in the world, and yet he's blessed by Jacob. And the Israelites would have understood this principle that it's the greater who blesses the lesser. And so I just think it would have resonated with them that at least in some way, Jacob was greater than Pharaoh. And now these Israelites, hundreds of years later reading this, are experiencing the deliverance that God is bringing to them, how God has defeated Pharaoh for the sake of his people and has delivered them, out of that bondage, not from that particular Pharaoh that Jacob faced, but from Pharaoh, from the Egyptian regime. and from the bondage and all of that. So I just think, you know, that's something that we can kind of gloss over. Read, okay, Jacob blessed Pharaoh, and then we kind of move on, because blessing isn't as much a part of our social interactions, but this was significant, and it had, you know, it carried meaning with it. And I think it really would have meant something for these Israelites coming out of Egypt hundreds of years later, who had been in bondage, who, you know, had been in bondage under their, the Pharaoh at that time, to have read and understood that their forefather blessed Abraham, and therefore, you know, at least in some way was greater than Pharaoh, and really greater than Pharaoh, I would say, because of the promises that God had made to Israel. So not anything that Jacob, you know, had done in and of himself necessarily, but because of the relationship that he had with God and the promises given to him.
And I guess I think it's going to serve as a testament to his faith, right? That here they are, the fifth generation is from Abraham going into the land.
Right.
There's still only 66 people.
Yeah.
And yet he has the faith to believe that he is greater than Pharaoh, and right. He has the faith to believe that he is going to be this great nation, even though they still are only 66.
Yeah, Wade makes a great point that it's also a testament to Jacob's faith, because here's Jacob, he's just 66 people, and yet he has the faith to see himself in this position of being greater than Pharaoh and in a position to in fact, to bless Pharaoh. Yeah, good point.
Hey, Greg.
Yeah, Clevin.
One more point that I saw too is how, I guess for the Egyptian culture, it would have been remarkable for Pharaoh to actually acknowledge Jacob's blessing, because Pharaoh would have been seen as himself a god to them. And, you know, for him to accept it, Jacob's blessing is a way of him acknowledging that Jacob was a man of God.
Right. Yeah, good point. And it is, you know, it is interesting. You think about Jacob, here's this old man. He's really just a shepherd. And how do the Egyptians feel about shepherds, right? Apparently they found shepherds to be loathsome. And yet he comes in front of Pharaoh and has that faith and that confidence to bless Pharaoh. So it's an interesting exchange. So, what request did Israel make of Joseph before dying? So now we're into the 47th chapter of Genesis. Right. Yeah. So Tony makes a point that, that Jacob asks Joseph, and really makes him swear that when the time comes for Jacob to die, that he would not be buried there in Egypt, but rather that he would be carried back up to Canaan and buried in a very specific place, buried in that cave that we talked about, the cave of Mamre that Abraham had purchased for that purpose. So and let's just go ahead and look at it in chapter 49. Verse 29. Now, this is after Jacob has died. Verse 29. Then he charged them and said to them, I'm about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought along with the field from Ephron the Hittite for a burial site. There they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah. There they buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it purchased from the sons of Heth. So that is right at the end of Jacob's life. Verse 33, when Jacob finished charging his sons, he drew his feet into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. So, interestingly, Rachel's not buried in the cave, right? We read about that earlier, that Rachel died, when she was giving birth to Benjamin. They were, Jacob and his whole household were traveling to Shechem. No, it was from Shechem but they were traveling, and they were near Bethlehem when Rachel died, and that's where she was buried. But Leah, Jacob's first wife, had the honor of being buried in this cave. So I think that's, you know, we know from reading the account how Jacob felt about Rachel versus Leah, but it's notable that Jacob did bury Leah. We don't read about Leah's death, I don't think, but we read that she was buried here in this cave, you know, along with the forefathers and the forefathers' wives. And Leah, of course, was Jacob's first wife, which is why she would have been buried there. So rewinding a little bit. So Jacob knows that the time for his death is near, and Jacob hears about this. In fact, it's in quotation marks when Jacob hears, you know, your father is sick. In fact, somebody's telling him this, Joseph telling that Jacob is sick. And so Joseph takes his two sons, who we read about earlier, Manasseh and Ephraim. And which one of those was the firstborn, you recall? Right. So Manasseh was the first one born. Remember, after Joseph had interpreted Pharaoh's dreams, he's elevated to this position and given a wife, and from the land of Egypt, who was the daughter of the priest of On. With that wife, then he has Manasseh and he has Ephraim. And so Joseph comes to Jacob with his two sons and has this dialogue with Jacob, where Jacob recounts some of his history and God's promises to him at Bethel. And then he makes an interesting kind of, I'm not sure what you call it, really, this decision, this determination that he would treat Manasseh and Ephraim as his own sons rather than as grandsons. So really he elevates Joseph's sons into this position of being treated as though they are Jacob's own sons, and really elevates Jacob in comparison now to the rest of his brothers, because now Jacob really has sort of twice as much of a part in the household, I guess, and the family, as he had before. And so Jacob conveys these blessings, you know, on Joseph and then also on each of his sons. Now, what's peculiar about the blessing or the blessings that Jacob bestows upon each of these two sons of Joseph, Manasseh and Ephraim? Yeah, Wade gestured it there. Yeah. So as Joseph is bringing the two sons and presenting them to Jacob, he has them positioned so that Jacob's right hand would be on Manasseh, the firstborn, and his left hand would be on Ephraim, the second son. But then Jacob switches his hands to put his right hand, which is the more important hand in conveying a blessing, on Ephraim, and his left hand on Manasseh. And how did Joseph feel about that? Yeah, it says he was displeased about that. So Joseph tries to correct it, and Jacob, you know, insists, and he refuses Joseph, and he insists, and it feels a lot like what happened when Jacob got the blessing from Isaac, because Esau was the firstborn, and, you know, Jacob supplanted Esau in the birthright and in the blessing. And so Jacob conveys the greater blessing upon Ephraim, which is interesting too, I think, when you think about their names. Do you recall what Ephraim's name meant? If you look back to the chapter and the account of his birth, the name Ephraim meant fruitful or fruitfulness. And then Manasseh's name actually meant to forget. And the idea there being that God had caused and helped Joseph to forget all of his sorrow and grief, you know, from his earlier life. So, names, we've seen this before, that names mean something and they have significance. And so, when Jacob speaks to Joseph in verse 48, he's recounting the promise that God had made to Jacob when Jacob was at Bethel and God spoke to him. So chapter 48 and verse 4, he's recounting this, and he tells Joseph, this is what God told me. Behold, I will make you fruitful and numerous. And so that was a part of the promise. And I think we've read that in other places too, this promise of being fruitful. And now Ephraim's name itself means fruitful, and Jacob directs the predominant blessing to Ephraim, the son whose name means fruitful. So just kind of an interesting connection there in how that all happened and transpired. It's interesting too that later on in history, and we can look at a few different places to see this, but in particular, if we just flip over to Isaiah chapter 11 for a moment. Later in history, the nation of Israel is referred to as Ephraim. That is the name that's used in addition or alongside with the nation of Israel, particularly after the children of Israel had divided into a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. There was Israel, and there was in the north, and Judah in the south. And then the northern kingdom was often referred to as Ephraim. So in chapter 11 of Isaiah, verse 13 is one place we see that. Then the jealousy of Ephraim will depart, and those who harass Judah, the southern kingdom, will be cut off. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, and Judah will not harass Ephraim. So just interesting, you know, that that the people of Israel, who form these 12 tribes, that two of the tribes are actually from Joseph. They're not, you know, directly sons of Jacob, but this is where, as we're coming to the end of Jacob's life, where he treats those two sons of Joseph as his own sons. And in fact, they each become their own tribe, and Ephraim, fruitful, actually becomes one of the stronger tribes and really, really becomes dominant in that northern kingdom later on in Israel's history. All right. So then sometime after this blessing exchange with Joseph's sons, Jacob really is near the end of his life. In chapter 49, he then calls together his sons, and he conveys a blessing upon each of the sons, from all the way from Reuben to Benjamin. He blesses each one. And in these, Ephraim and Manasseh are not included. So they've already gotten their blessing. Joseph is included, however, in the blessings that are recorded in chapter 49. And remember that Joseph himself, there is no tribe of Joseph. Joseph doesn't get a tribe. He gets two tribes. He gets Ephraim and Manasseh later on when they do become a nation. So there's a blessing that that Jacob conveys to each of his sons, starting with Reuben. You know, and some of the things are good that he says, and some things are not so good. So for Reuben, you know, there's some things that he mentions there that are not so good. And same with Simeon and Levi. But then he gets to Judah, and let's just look at that one, because what are the blessings that are conveyed to Judah? Start there in verse 8.
Your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down before you. Judah's a lion's cub. He stooped down, he crouched, and so on.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Right, so very, very exalted blessings given to Judah. Your brothers shall praise you. He's going to be victorious. His hand will be on the neck of his enemies. His father's son shall bow down to you. He's referred to as having the strength of a lion, really. A lion's whelp or cub, being the young offspring of a lion. And maybe one of the most important parts of this is this statement that the scepter will not depart from Judah. The scepter being really the symbol of authority and ruling. And then, you know, other references as well to prophecy. not other references to the prosperity that that the nation of Judah would have. So we know that David, you know, Solomon, all the kings of Judah, in fact, the southern kingdom, they all descended from Judah. And importantly, we know that Jesus himself descended from Judah. So that is the lineage and the heritage of Jesus. And then just to look at one reference, which I think is maybe one of the more familiar ones we have that harkens back to this prophetic blessing that Jacob gives, is in Revelation. In Revelation chapter 5, which we looked at not that long ago. Revelation chapter 5 is that scene that John sees in heaven with the book that's sealed. No one's strong enough to open it. And then, you know, John is distressed. He's weeping because no one's strong enough to open it. And then he turns and verse 4, then I began to weep greatly because no one was found worthy to open the book or to look into it. And one of the elders said to me, stop weeping. Behold, the lion that is from the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has overcome so as to open the book and its seven seals. So there's no doubt that this blessing conveyed to Judah is a messianic prophecy from Jacob, looking forward to Jesus and to the Messiah. Now, it's interesting, I think, when we look in, you know, Hebrews chapter 11, we've been flipping back and forth a lot between these accounts and the histories and the narratives we've been reading through so far in the Old Testament and these characters. In Hebrews chapter 11, when we look at what the writer, what the Holy Spirit mentioned when it came to Jacob, because Jacob, you know, we've been reading about him now for quite a bit of Genesis is devoted to Jacob and his household, his family, things that he did, a lot of events. There's only one verse in Hebrews chapter 11 devoted to Jacob's life and his example of faith, and it's what he does right here at the end of his life. So in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 21, by faith Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped, leaning on the top of his staff. So, you know, that's kind of the one thing that the Holy Spirit wants to use from the life of Jacob to illustrate faith in the life of God's people. And I guess what I take away from that is if we look at the life of Jacob, there's kind of this crescendo of faith. He doesn't necessarily start out as what we might consider, you know, a man of God, right? There's deception in his life. There's doubt. There's just a lot of dysfunction in his family and so forth. But I think what we do see a progression in his life and a progression of faith, such that here at the end of his life, maybe he sees clearly what God's plan was. He understands the promise. Maybe how that promise is ultimately going to be fulfilled through his lineage, and that's the point that's picked up then by the writer of Hebrews to really demonstrate faith in the life of Jacob. So Jacob delivers these blessings, and as we read, then he draws his feet into his bed, breathes his last, and he's gathered to his people. So Joseph reacts strongly to this. We don't read about the reactions of his brothers right at the moment of Jacob's death, but we do of Joseph and how he felt. And one thing that's kind of interesting, you know, sometimes there's a lot of symmetry that we see. So when Joseph was sold down to Egypt, he was about 17 years old. And if you do the math on the age when Jacob was when he entered Egypt and was reunited with Joseph to when he died, Jacob and Joseph are together there in Egypt for about 17 years. So they were together kind of 17 years at the start of Joseph's life, and then the final 17 years of Jacob's life there in Egypt. So Joseph orders Jacob to be embalmed, which was the practice there in Egypt. And there's this great, you know, entourage then that proceeds with Jacob's body back up to Canaan, as he had requested and had asked Joseph to swear that he would do, that he would bury Jacob there. And they reach a location that's referred to as the threshing floor of Atad. And there's they engage then in this great mourning and this grieving, such that the Canaanites who are in the area there, they see it. And what's their observation from what they're seeing from this kind of this funeral procession that has come up from Egypt?
They say this is a grievous mourning by the Egyptians.
That's right. The Canaanites themselves observe in chapter 50 and verse 11, this is a grievous mourning. They could tell that, you know, this was a significant event to the Egyptians, and whoever it was who had passed away was a significant person to them. So here's Jacob. You know, he's an old man. He comes down to Egypt. He does live there for a few years. He's a shepherd, basically. And yet he established himself, I think, and conducted himself there in such a way that by the time of his death, it wasn't just his family that brought him, but there were the elders of the Egypt and Pharaoh is, I don't know if Pharaoh himself is there, but he's certainly sponsoring along with Joseph this great, you know, entourage and funeral procession, such that it's something that is noticeable to the Canaanites. So Jacob is buried there then, finally in the cave, the burial cave in Mamre. And after Jacob's death, his Joseph's brothers are concerned. What's their concern at this point in time?
Joseph's wrath.
Yeah, right. So yeah, Tiberius makes the point that, you know, now that Jacob is gone, Joseph's brothers are now afraid, even after all these years, that Joseph is now going to seek revenge against his brothers for the way that they had mistreated him, you know, years and years ago. And it's just interesting how long that guilt had stayed with his brothers, you know. And it's not just what they did. It's the years and years of carrying on that lie and that deception against Jacob for what they had done to Joseph. And clearly, and we saw some of this when they are back in the presence of Joseph and they're feeling that guilt, you know, throughout that incident as well. And so, you know, they're feeling this guilt and they're feeling the potential jeopardy that they're in. So they speak to Joseph. It says they send a message, but they also speak to Joseph. And it's interesting because I don't know that it's an honest message. They say, well, your father, you know, before you died, your father said, please forgive your brothers for the way that they treated you. We don't have any record of Jacob telling his brothers that he was going to make that request. So there's even some further deception, perhaps even in this. But that's, you know, that's how they present that to Joseph. And what's Joseph's response? Which is just really is so typical of Joseph.
Do not fear. Am I in the place of God?
Well, first he went.
Yeah. So we're in chapter 50 and verse 19, as Larry points out, he says, do not be afraid. You know, and he asks a rhetorical question, for am I in God's place? And then he says, you know, you meant evil for me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this salvation, this preservation of his people. Bill.
Joseph really models how important humility is to true faith.
Yeah.
Because even going all the way back when interpreting the dream, right when he's given his dream, he said, well, he's going to be some, he'll torture the younger brother and he, you know, lacks social skills and his kid sounds like he's arrogant. But then when he's in Egypt, of course, he said it when God gives him the power of interpreting.
Yeah. Yeah, Bill, it just makes a really great point of just the importance of humility and how Joseph really models humility as such an important part of faith. And, you know, Joseph is just one of these characters, kind of outstanding, kind of like Daniel, where we don't read anything bad in Joseph's life. And just everything we read about Joseph's life, it's upstanding, full of faith, no fear, does the right thing at the right time, says the right thing at the right time. Just really a strong example for us to follow. And that includes the humility too, because here you got Joseph. He's second in only to Pharaoh in all the land of Egypt. He himself has, brought about the salvation of Egypt through, through God. God, of course, revealed the meaning of Pharaoh's dream to him. But, Pharaoh Joseph is just really, really, important in Egypt, and he's exalted, and he's got just about as much, as much power as Pharaoh. So he certainly could have, sought revenge. He could have carried out his own will against his brothers, but he just doesn't do that. He just reassures them, tells them not to be afraid. He sees God in everything that has happened in his life, and he's seen and acknowledged God in all of that. He comforts them. He speaks kindly to them. It's really just it's striking. So Joseph lives 110 years, and then we get to the end of his life. And what does Joseph say to his brothers at the end of his life? Which again shows the faith of Joseph. Yeah, thanks. So Joe points out that Joseph says, God will take care of you. So kind of like, even though I'm leaving now, I'm dying, but God is going to take care of you. And he's going to bring you up from this land as he had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So Joseph acknowledges the promises that had been made to God and to his forefathers. And then importantly, he asks for his bones ultimately to be carried up out of Egypt. And when we get into Exodus, we will see that happen. We'll see the Israelites, when they leave Egypt, they bring Joseph's remains with them up to Canaan, just as he had asked. And so that really indicates, the faith of Joseph, that he could see what God was ultimately going to carry out and make happen. He believed the promises that had been made. And again, we don't see a lot about Joseph in Hebrews chapter 11, but this is one thing that we do see. So in Hebrews chapter 11, just turning back over there briefly, and verse 22, we see, by faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his faith. So, there's a lot of things that could have been said about Joseph in Hebrews chapter 11, but this is the one thing that is brought out and is mentioned there by the Holy Spirit. It's interesting that we don't have any record of God speaking directly to Joseph. We see God speaking to Abraham. We see him speaking to Isaac. We've seen him, as we talked about this morning, speaking to Jacob. But we don't see any record, at least, of God speaking directly to Joseph. Now, God revealed the interpretation of dreams, certainly, to Joseph, and Joseph acknowledged that. But we don't, we don't hear promises being made by God to Joseph the way that they were made to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob explicitly. So for Joseph to have had the level of faith that he has shown in his life without even having that direct dialogue with God, I think even speaks perhaps more about his faith. And you think about, he was only 17 years old when he was sold off down to Egypt. So here's this young boy, and he's already got this strong faith that has really served him through that whole experience, through being in jail, through being presented in front of Pharaoh, and then leading the nation of Egypt with regard to preparation for the famine, and seeing God's plan and how he's dealing with his family and bringing the family from Canaan into Egypt, and ultimately they're going to become a nation. And he seems to see all of that and understand and believe all of that. And yet he's just a young boy when he's sent, really stolen or sold and taken down to Egypt. It's really just, it's striking. It's pretty amazing. And yet the promise, we're told a lot about Joseph. We're not told a whole lot about Judah. And yet we know Judah is the one really through whom the promise ultimately is going to be fulfilled, and through whom the Messiah will come. It's not through Joseph. Judah does figure still somewhat prominently among, you know, compared to the other brothers. We've seen some things that he's done in his life. And we're told something interesting about Judah, I think, over in Genesis chapter, kind of going back to the first part of this morning study in Genesis chapter 46. This is when Jacob and his household, they are now traveling down to Egypt. And in the 46th chapter, verse 28, now he, meaning Jacob, sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out the way before him to Goshen. And they came into the land of Goshen. So, you know, earlier this, I guess, Wednesday night, we were talking about Joseph and the interaction that Judah does kind of figure prominently there. And then I think it's just interesting, and I think it's a type, really, that as Jacob is leading his family down into Egypt, he picks out Judah and sends him ahead to point out the way, or to really kind of prepare the way. And when we look at Hebrews chapter 6, you know, something similar is said about Christ. Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 19. This hope we have as an anchor of the soul, a hope both sure and steadfast, and one which enters within the veil, where Jesus has entered as a forerunner for us, having become a high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. So, you know, you can find types and foreshadows and all that really throughout the Old Testament. And, you know, not trying to read too much into this, but I do think it's an interesting type where Jacob sends Judah, you know, of all the sons and all the people he could have chosen, he chooses Judah to send ahead and to point out the way. And that just, I think to me, that stands as a type of Christ who is a forerunner for us, in our salvation as well. So, any final thoughts from the life of Joseph, the end of the life of Joseph, Jacob, anything with regard, in particular with drawing near to God, which is, you know, continues to be our focus this year?
Right.
Bill.
You mentioned that Joseph, we're not given any account of failings in his life, similar with Daniel. And there's some others like Isaiah, Jeremiah.
Right.
They're prophets. But the other thing that's sort of sobering maybe is what both Daniel and Joseph's lives prepared for, unjust suffering.
Yeah.
They were both persecuted, suffered unjustly. By contrast, Jacob really didn't suffer.
Yeah.
Right? Jacob's life was one of success and wealth. Even Abram.
Yeah.
Were wealthy.
Yeah.
And the brothers, we don't really see the other brothers suffering.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's an element of a sober reflection in our life, being like Daniel and Joseph, being close to God. They mean enduring unjust suffering, resting on God's power to overcome it. By contrast, having a life where we don't have suffering, and we have prosperity and success, can be one that lays traps for us, snares.
Yeah, thanks for that. That's a really good point. So yeah, Bill makes a really good point that in the life of Joseph, we don't see failings similar to Daniel and some others, but what's similar between Joseph and Daniel is their having to experience unjust suffering, and that very well may be a part of drawing near to God and having that upright character, and that if we're living a life where we're not suffering, perhaps we need to examine ourselves, consider whether we're really being faithful and, in fact, drawing near to God. So good. Thank you for that. All right. Thanks, everyone.